From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, leading the team that performed the first near-total face transplant in the U.S., we talk with Dr. Maria Shemyanov about the 22-hour microsurgery on Connie Culp, whose face was shattered by a shotgun blast. Dr. Shemyanov is the director of plastic surgery research at Cleveland Clinic. She has a new memoir about microsurgery and her quest to perform the first full face transplant. Also, Anna Paquin talks about her starring role on the HBO vampire series True Blood, which begins its second season Sunday, and about winning an Oscar at the age of 11 for the 1993 film The Piano. And in honor of the 50th anniversary of Gypsy, the original cast recording has been reissued in a special edition. Lloyd Schwartz has a review. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More than any other part of our body, the face defines our identity. It expresses emotion and has the gateways to taste, sight, smell, and hearing. I guess that's why the idea of a facial transplant still seems so shocking. In late 2008, my guest, Dr. Maria Shemyanov, led the team at Cleveland Clinic that performed the first near-total face transplant in the U.S. The patient was Connie Culp. Her husband had shot her in the face with a shotgun. The transplant was performed 4 years after the hospital's institutional review board announced that it considered a face transplant to be both ethical and possible. Dr. Shemyanov grew up in Poland and first came to the U.S. for a fellowship in hand surgery at the Institute for Hand and Microsurgery in Louisville, Kentucky. She's now Cleveland Clinic's Director of Plastic Surgery Research and the head of microsurgery training. She's written a new memoir called Face to Face. Dr. Shemyanov, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about some of the reasons a facial transplant is so complicated, and let's start with one of the reasons why you have to do a facial transplant as opposed to just taking skin grafts from the person's body. I was amazed reading your book that there's so much facial tissue that you wouldn't have enough skin to graft on your body. Just give us a sense of the amount of tissue that's involved in a facial transplant.
Yes, when you want to cover a face with a perfect sheath of the skin, you really do not have enough of skin in your body which is pliable, which has the same texture, the same color, and also have a vascular supply, meaning that it's really having a normal life like a tissue in your other parts of the body. And for this reason, quite often you can see that the patients who are victims of the burn and trauma injuries have a kind of a patchwork of a skin of different colors on their face, because some of the grafts taken from your own body are taken from different parts of the body. So you can have a piece of the skin taken from the thigh, you can have a piece of the skin taken from your back or from your buttocks. So as an effect, it gives an artificial, not natural look on the face.
Now, in the book, you talk about the complexity of motion that's allowed by the muscles and tissues of the face. Can you just give us a very brief tour of the face, and so that we can follow along on our own faces as we listen? And that'll also give us a sense of how complex a procedure a facial transplant is.
Well, if you go from the front of your face, starting with a forehead, and then like you are washing actually your face every morning, you can feel exactly that you go through the surfaces which are totally plain, like a forehead. Then you go to your eyelids, which are a little hollow, where your eyes are covered. Then you go over nose, which is again raised and has its own prominence. Then you go down to your lips, which have a very different type of prominence and different texture. And then you go down to your chin, which is again a little more prominent and standing out. Then imagine the patients who are now missing at least one component, such as nose. So when they wash their face in the morning, they are just not only going through the hollow of their ears or the hollow of their eyes, but then they have a hollow where we all have a prominence, such as nose. And that's what is probably very disturbing on a daily basis, because quite often for some of the patients who do not have nose, they even cannot take a shower in the morning because the water will not allow them to take a shower, will go down to their throat.
One of the things you have to do in a face transplant is remove the face from the body of the donor. So what are you removing when you remove their face? Obviously the skin. But what else besides the skin are you taking?
This will very much depend on the patient who is a recipient of the transplant. And this will vary from patient to patient depending on what kind of trauma they have, which caused them to be disfigured and have this functional disability. In the situation of our patient, we were removing not only the coverage, which is the facial skin, but also the three-dimensional functional units, including bones, the bones of the nose, the lower eyelids, the upper bones of the upper jaw, also sinuses, heart palate, as well as upper lip. So as you can imagine, it is a very, very complex. 80% of face of the donor was removed in order to cover the very deep defect of our patient.
So was the donor's face removed in one piece, or did you have like several different sections and pieces?
No, that was in one piece, and we have prepared as a team to this type of live transplantation by a series of what we call mock transplantations in anatomy lab, where as a team we were meeting on weekends and we were mimicking the transplant which we will perform on our patient. And this was based on a three-dimensional CT scan of our patient's defect. So we knew exactly what we are doing. As a team of eight surgeons, we are working almost the same as on the day of surgery, a real transplant. We're working in anatomy lab on two operating tables, and we're just creating the defect on one potential patient and then transferring the transplant from another anatomy lab cadaver. So this was a very long preparation to the surgery, so we haven't done it just without thinking about every detail, anatomical detail, what kind of arteries, what kind of veins, what kind of nerves we need, also about complexity of the bones, and to be sure, as you rightly ask, that they have to be taken in a one piece which is intact.
So I'd like you to describe the face of the facial transplant recipient, who was a victim of a gunshot wound. She was shot in the face by her husband. So what was her face by the time you were doing the face transplant? And I should back up and say, I think you or another team of surgeons had performed several facial reconstructive surgeries, but it still wasn't sufficient to give her a real face.
Yes, she was missing major functions of possibility of breathing through the nose because she did not have a nose. She was lacking an upper lip, and she was also missing lower eyelids. And most of her skin was either scarred or damaged on about 80% of her face. So what we have to replace was the entire nose with nasal passages, sinuses, also upper lip, lower eyelids, and the heart palate, which was missing.
And since she only had a hole where her nose was, she was breathing through a surgically created hole in her trachea.
Yeah, she was a tracheostomy tube, so she was breathing through the tube.
So, did you have to find a donor whose facial proportions kind of matched the recipient's facial proportions, so that the eyelids would fall in the right place and the nose would fall proportionately in the right place?
This really, if we would be looking into the matching, could be difficult. We were really lucky that the donor was really matching our patient's features. So that was a light complexion of the skin, similar width and length of the skeleton, as well as the fact, of course, that she was a female, because that's very important, that the donor can be matched for the gender and for the complexion of the skin and for the race. So this was the first donor which signed donor family sign consent for the donation of the face. And really amazingly, I must say, we were so lucky that we couldn't believe that the difference in the color of our patient's, for example, forehead on her own chin, which was left, was exactly matching the color of the donor. So even today, it's very difficult, except that there is a little bit of scar tissue, which is not very visible, to recognize which color is coming from the donor, which part of the face is hers.
Well, the transplant surgery took over 20 hours. One of the things you had to do was take the blood vessels from the donor's face and attach them to blood vessels in the recipient's body. You're working in this world of microsurgery. Would you give us some sense of what it takes to attach the small blood vessels of one face to another?
Well, if you think about, for example, the fact that artery under magnification of the microscope has a hollow appearance, which is a little flat because of the fact that there is no blood flowing through it when you do that. And it's white, it's kind of without appearance of blood in it. So that looks really like spaghetti, which got flattened out. And then you are just connecting this spaghetti from one end to another end, and you are trying to reconstruct the hollow structure and three-dimensional structure of this artery. And once you are done, and you are actually using a very small sutures, the needle is small, the thread is very small, and if you compare them, for example, the thread is about 40 microns in diameter, which reminds the size of the human hair. So if you can imagine that you are putting the stitches with something as thin as a human hair under magnification of 20 times, and you are just looking through the loops and you are concentrated on what you do, and after, for example, 40, 50 minutes of reconstructing this spaghetti into the hollow element, which at some point becomes pink when you take the clamps off, and you see that the blood is going through this new reconstructed artery, and it's actually not leaking, and it's starting to pulsate, and you almost hear in your ears bum, 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 and you know it's working.
In order to get a facial transplant, you have to take immune suppressive drugs for the rest of your life, unless something better comes along. But otherwise, your body will reject this transplant. So what are the long-term effects of taking immune suppressive drugs? I mean, in addition to leaving you vulnerable to a lot of disease, do they shorten your life? I mean, are they likely to wipe years off your life?
Potentially, the difference between the transplant patients of the solid organs and our patient of what is known as composite graft and faces, an example of composite graft, is the fact that these are usually healthy patients. So to start with, they do not have like a renal failure for the kidney transplant patients, which are usually a very sick patients. But the side effects are the same, and that's a very important question, Terry, because we have presented to our patient all the risks and benefits, and we have outlined what may happen. We have presented the risk of developing diabetes, of potential kidney failure in years to come. But we are hoping that with the healthy patient to start, with our protocol of minimal immunosuppression, trying to wean off patient from immunosuppression, we at least will be able to help her to go through many years without major side effects. But these are really significant factors to consider when you present to the patient the risk and benefits of face transplantation.
My guest is Dr. Maria Shemyanov. In late 2008, she led the team that performed the first near-total face transplant in the U.S. She's the director of plastic surgery research and head of the microsurgical training unit at the Cleveland Clinic's Department of Plastic Surgery. She's written a new book called Face to Face, My Quest to Perform the First Full Face Transplant. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Maria Shemyanov, and she led the team that performed the first face transplant in the United States. This was in December of 2008, and she's at the Cleveland Clinic, where she's the director of plastic surgery research. How was Connie Culp chosen to be the first recipient in America of a facial transplant?
Well, she was fulfilling many of the requirements as per our institutional review board, IRB protocol, which the first one was that from the very beginning we're considering as a potential candidate only patients who have exhausted all potential conventional means of reconstruction. The second was that the patient has to be psychologically stable, and she was evaluated and was found to be in a good spirits and very eager to go through the procedure. The third was also ethical evaluation, that the patient was evaluated by our ethics experts to understand that she will be a first patient, that it bears a lot of ethical issues as well as the fact that she is a research patient. And understanding what does it mean that she is a research subject, meaning that we cannot tell her exactly what will be the outcome, because not many patients like that were done worldwide, that she will be in a way example for others to follow up how her face transplant over time will be doing, how she will be doing as a patient, how she will be integrated into society. The next important part was to find out the social and family support, who will be supporting her not only before transplant, but also after transplant. And all these things were a prerequisite of considering her as a potential candidate.
How is Connie Culp now? She was the first recipient of a facial transplant. You led the team that performed the surgery. So what does her face look like now?
Well, her face looks like a normal human face, which is very important. You know, she has a beautiful nose, actually. She has a little, maybe too much on the sides of her skin, and that was taken purposely. And we will remove the part on the side of just only her skin, which was used also for biopsies to monitor her rejection. But really, if you think and you see her on the street and you don't know her just from the media and recognize her as a face transplant patient, then she's now going back to her grocery stores in her community. She was walking her dog. She's exercising. She's just back to her normal life.
And does she look anything like the donor looked? Is Connie's face similar to her donor's face?
No, it's not, and this is a good question, because quite often the question was posed in, you know, how much of the donor look and how much of the recipient look will the face transplant patient have. And since we were adjusting the bones and we are adjusting the width and depth to her own skeleton, she still have her own face reconstructed. And I would say, of course, you can on the computer models when colleagues and ourselves were evaluating a potential of how the recipient will look like a donor and vice versa. And also in anatomy lab, we were just doing a kind of mock cadaver studies, looking at the different sizes of skeletons. We found that the most of the simulated transplants look as kind of a mixture between themselves and the donor.
How often do you see Connie Culp now?
Well, we are at this point seeing her even on a weekly basis right now. And as long as she will be doing fine, in the beginning, we are a little more careful in evaluating her more often. But we are, for the first year, thinking about just having a monthly schedule. So if everything goes well and there are no signs of kind of a rejection or suspicion, which we have not so far seen, once a month visit for not only myself, but team members, as well as psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, and having her blood drawn and looking at all possible needed during the follow-up visits of, for example, functional re-education, physical therapy. So there will be a checklist of things which we want to be sure we are pretty closely monitoring.
I wonder if you see faces differently than you used to now that you've done a face transplant.
Probably I do. And, you know, sometimes I look at all these beauty shows, you know, and shows where they are showing like a total makeover. Not that I look at them every day, but this is something which I always wonder if people are not really exaggerating with changes of quite often beautiful faces, even what is now like a more beautiful because you need a little bigger lips or you need a little, you know, more narrow a nose or something like that. I think we should be happy with what we are if we have just normal looking human faces.
Dr. Shemyanov, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Maria Shemyanov has written a new memoir called Face to Face. She's Cleveland Clinic's Director of Plastic Surgery Research and the head of microsurgery training. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information is available at progressive.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new 50th anniversary edition of the original cast recording of Gypsy has been released. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And Anna Paquin talks about her starring role in the HBO vampire series True Blood. Season 2 begins Sunday. She won an Oscar at age 11 for her performance in The Piano. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO vampire series True Blood begins its second season Sunday, and season one just came out on DVD. My guest, Anna Paquin, stars as Sookie Stackhouse. Sookie isn't a vampire, but she's in love with one, Bill. He became a vampire during the Civil War and has tried to maintain the gentility he had as a human. But that's hard to do when you're a vampire. Sookie has a special gift which sets her apart from humans. She's able to read their thoughts. That gift is often a burden because she can't shut off their thoughts, and what people are thinking is often not very pleasant. She can't read the thoughts of vampires like Bill, and that's one reason she finds it calming to be in his presence. Anna Paquin won an Oscar at age 11 for her performance in the 1993 film The Piano. Let's start with a scene from the new season of True Blood. Season 1 ended with Sookie killing in self-defense the man who had murdered several women in town. But another murder remains unsolved. Who killed her uncle, the uncle who had abused her when she was younger, something she had confided in Bill?
Did you have anything to do with Uncle Bartlett's death?
He hurt you.
Oh, my God. Is it that easy for you to kill? Does human life mean so little you can just kill on command, toss someone in the water? I cannot have people dying every time I confide in you. I never felt more inhuman than when I had to kill Renee. It still haunts me. And now you've made me feel like I killed another person. I feel sick. I always thought as different as we are, somehow we could still be together. And now I don't know. I don't know anything. Please. Say something, Bill.
I cannot, and I will not lose you for all the ways I have dismayed, aggrieved, or failed you. I swear I will atone. But I am not sorry. I refuse to apologize for what you have awakened in me. You are my miracle, Sookie. For the first time in 140 years, I felt something I thought had been lost to me forever. I love you. And for that, I shall never feel sorry.
How dare you, Bill Compton? I love you.
Anna Paquin, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoy your performance on the show. Most movies and dramas are heightened versions of reality. They're just more dramatic than reality. Mm-hmm.
Or you condense a lot of really dramatic, real moments into a short amount of time that makes it appear more dramatic.
Exactly. But a story like True Blood is even more exaggerated and more dramatic because so many of the characters have some kind of secret power or gift that they can use for good or evil. And things are especially heightened in the romance scenes because, like in your romance scenes with Bill, there's a certain danger because, after all, he is a vampire. And arousal brings out his fangs, which recede in regular life. And he sometimes bites your neck while making love. How does all that affect how you play those love scenes together?
Well, you play it for the reality. You play it for the emotional truth of it. And the things like fangs and blood gags and effects, those, I think, serve to make the story more exciting and to heighten the reality. But basically, it's two people who are falling for each other, experiencing something really intimate together. And for him, when his fangs come out, he's scared that she's going to pull away. And instead, you know, it's them being literally bare before each other and accepting each other for who they really are.
So let's talk a little bit about the special effects aspect of True Blood. Mm-hmm. Like in season one, you are near death, and I think your back has been broken in an attack because you can't feel your legs. And
Sookie gets almost killed on multiple occasions.
Yeah,
I'd just like to point out.
And Bill the vampire shows up to rescue you and explains that you should feed on his blood because vampire blood has restorative powers. Vampires try to keep that a secret. So you have to
I feed off of his arm.
You feed off of his arm. So what are you doing for real in that scene?
For real, there was a guy named Dan from Masters FX with a prosthetic arm that is exact replica of Steve's arm, except made out of latex, complete with hairs on the arm that were individually like threaded through the latex. There's a tube up the inside. There's an opening, and it's like an animatronic arm. And Steve has his arm sort of taped or stashed behind his back, and Dan is maneuvering the fake arm, which has a blood pump attached to it, which I then am supposed to drink gallons, well, actually kind of did drink gallons and gallons of blood from, / have it run all over my face at about 4 or 5 in the morning while we were fighting the sun from coming up in the back lot in the Warner Brothers jungle.
Oh, yeah, good point, because he can't be in daylight, so you
have
to do
a lot of
shooting.
Yeah, so all of those nighttime scenes,
night, yeah.
Well, obviously there's a lot of night shooting, but also, you know, there's a limited number of hours of nighttime, so by the end of the night, you know, you're racing to get everything done, and because of the messy nature of a lot of the blood gags, often they're left to last because a massive cleanup is not really an option in the middle of a shooting day, night. So, yeah, so... interesting.
So what is the blood that you're feeding on? What's it made out of?
I actually don't know. I would imagine it's some kind of food coloring type situation, but it has, depending on what it has to be used for, it has a different consistency. They offered me low carb blood because they were being considerate of my, you know, short shorts diet. And being an idiot, I said, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you know, low-carb blood, i.e. flavorless blood, really gross after, like, the first 10 takes of feeding off it through a latex arm, which already tastes like, I don't know, dead and nasty. I was kind of regretting going the girly girl route on that after the sort of first few gulps because, you know, a little sugary watermelon, strawberry flavored, something or other, I think might have made it go down a little easier.
So they couldn't have just put in some vanilla extract or something, take the edge off?
I have no, I mean, there's different flavors of blood. I mean, they make it in different flavors depending on who's going to be drinking it and what they prefer. Yeah, so lesson learned.
Your character, Sookie, is... She seems like she'd be a tomboy, but she dresses very, like, tomboy sexy. She wears shorts and tank tops, but they're very revealing tank tops. But they're very plain tank tops.
She's a practical girl. She has a limited budget, and she lives somewhere where it's, like, 110 degrees
exactly,
outside during
right.
the summertime. You know, but she's athletic and comfortable in her body and comfortable in her skin and confident.
So it takes a lot of fittings to get something that looks like it was bought at the local Walmart or something.
Except, ironically, my costume actually, my Sookie shorts, my waitress shorts from last season, they were off the rack Old Navy. And the T-shirt was just American Apparel. But it's the matter of finding the right, you know, the exact right item and the right bra. You know, it's gotta look right. Also, one of the things that we do try to do in the costume fittings and in the, as far as each character, is not shopping too far outside of the budget of the actual character. So the fact that we have Sookie in a lot of stuff that is, you know, from Target or Old Navy or sort of, you know, similarly not high-end stores, I think is really appropriate because she obviously wouldn't be able to afford some really snazzy design or something or other with her lifestyle and with her salary. And I kind of like, you know, whereas some of the vampires have these really fabulous closets of clothes because they've been around a really long time, and in the sort of, you know, the premise of our show, I guess, have figured out how to be rich because they all seem to drive fantastic cars and wear expensive clothes, and that sort of, you know, they've got it figured out over the last, you know, few thousand years.
My guest is Anna Paquin. She stars in the HBO vampire series True Blood. Season 2 premieres Sunday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anna Paquin, and she's now starring in True Blood on HBO. Now, you and your co-star, Stephen Moyer, who plays the vampire mm-hmm. Bill that you're in love with, you're mm-hmm. a couple in real life now, right?
Yes.
Now, it must be funny to to be in a real romantic relationship while playing characters whose relationship is so powerful because she has special powers that will prevent her from ever being herself with any human man. At least that's what Bill's convinced her of. And he's a vampire. So, like, when they come together, I mean, it's just, like, such drama. mm-hmm. It's like no human relationship, I think, could, like, quite measure up to the drama that surrounds theirs. So you play that dramatic relationship. So is it funny to be in a real relationship while playing this, like, super heightened, dramatic, you know, vampire mind reader relationship?
I mean, I don't know it any other way as far as my particular job and my particular relationship. I mean, you know, obviously, the reason we were cast opposite each other is because we had chemistry. So that energy has been there from day one. And, you know, this is how we've grown as a couple. So it's kind of hard to imagine it any other way. I mean, it's kind of funny when you think about it that, you know, we go to work and that's some of the scenarios we end up and you know, as far as our job is concerned, but that's just the way it is.
Did having a real relationship affect the on-screen chemistry and make it either stronger or any different?
Well, I think that with any acting in any medium, really trusting the people that you're with makes it easier to go to deeper and more open and scary places. And being as how a lot of the Bill and Sookie plotline is physically demanding in various ways, it's really great to completely and utterly trust the person that you're in those scenes with. And I think it just makes it easier.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Anna Paquin, and she stars in the HBO series True Blood. Now, everybody knows that you won an Oscar at the age of 11 mm-hmm. for your portrayal as in The Piano, the Jane Campion movie, which is set in the outback of New Zealand. And without getting into a kind of complicated story here, let's just say it's a kind of transgressive version of a romance fantasy, with Holly Hunter playing your mother, and she kind of symbolizes creativity. She refuses to speak, but she plays this, like, wild, beautiful piano. And Harvey Keitel kind of symbolizes masculinity freed from the constraints of European
literacy,
morality. Yeah. And European repression. He's freed mm-hmm. from European repression. So in this film, you witness your stepfather chopping off your mother's forefinger with an axe mm-hmm. in punishment for her infidelity with Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. And you witness the infidelity when you peek through a keyhole and see your mother lying naked with Harvey Keitel. I'm guessing mm-hmm. that when you shot this, you didn't actually see Harvey Keitel naked.
No, I did not. They, as with most films, shoot the interiors on stages, and the exterior where I was peeking through, there was a bunch of camera equipment inside covered with, you know, blue, like, rain-protecting gear. Yeah, also, that I didn't even get a full version of the script. There was a cut and paste in a scrapbook that I had.
Oh,
because,
interesting.
I was 9, and that wouldn't have been appropriate.
Yeah, well, and Harvey Keitel is totally full frontal in this. So when the movie came out, did your parents let you watch the movie?
No. I got to see, like, the first 20 minutes.
How strange was that to get an Oscar for a movie that you're in and yet not be allowed to watch it?
Well, I mean, I wasn't allowed to watch many films that were.
But you weren't in them.
I know, but I've done a lot of stuff that wasn't really necessarily age appropriate for me viewing wise. I don't know. I mean, I didn't know it any other way, so it didn't seem odd. I mean, the whole thing was odd.
Yeah, the whole
being
thing
in a movie
odd.
Was
right.
odd.
Right.
Being in New Zealand 1 minute and then being, you know, in LA winning an Oscar and having lots of people that you've never met before in your entire life wanting to talk to you and staring at you and all that. I mean, the whole thing was very, I mean, statistically very improbable, if you like. So that wasn't really the weirdest part, I wouldn't imagine.
So I know you were protected from seeing things in the movie that would be upsetting, but in the movie your character witnesses her mother's finger being chopped off with an axe.
Yeah, that was pretty unpleasant.
So you did witness it?
Yeah.
Did it scare you?
I honestly don't remember. I mean, it was, you know, those sorts of scenes, I mean... Yeah, at the time it felt intense, but it was also, I don't know, it was really muddy and they had the rain machines and it was cold. And I'd been working with those people for several months. So the, you know, the line between real and fiction in that kind of instance was pretty well in place, you know. So I don't know. I don't remember being scared. Because I knew it wasn't obviously happening. I got to play with the rubber axe.
Oh. Right, so you could see it was rubber.
Yeah, you know, like they were very good about that sort of stuff. Like, uh-huh. And here's the finger.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Anna Paquin stars in the HBO vampire series True Blood. Season 2 begins Sunday night. Season 1 just came out on DVD. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a 50th anniversary edition of the original cast recording of Gypsy. This is Fresh Air. Gypsy, the Julie Stein, Stephen Sondheim musical based on the autobiography of stripper Gypsy Rose Lee and starring Ethel Merman as Lee's monster of a mother, opened on Broadway in 1959 and ran for 702 performances. Critic Walter Kerr famously called it the best damn musical I've seen in years. On the 50th anniversary of Gypsy, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz still agrees with that assessment.
Some people sit on their butts, got the dream, yeah, but not the guts. That's living for some people, for some humdrum people, I suppose.
Although West Side Story may be more directly related to Shakespeare, Gypsy might very well be at heart the most Shakespearean of all Broadway musicals. When I was in graduate school, some of my classmates concocted a musical version of Hamlet, putting new lyrics to the songs from Gypsy. Critic Frank Rich once said that Gypsy was the Broadway musical's answer to King Lear. I think the two greatest stage performances I ever saw were the great Shakespearean actor Paul Scofield's King Lear and Ethel Merman as Rose Hovick, the ruthlessly ambitious mother of actress June Havoc and superstar stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. In the ferocity of her sense of betrayal by the daughter who achieves the success she wanted for herself, Merman rose to tragic heights. Rose's turn, her big final soliloquy, is the Broadway version of a real operatic mad scene. Good as Merman's successors may have been, none of them came anywhere near her in this number.
Why did I do it? Why did it get me? Scrapbooks full of me in the background. Give them love, and what does it get you? What does it get you? One quick look as each of them leaves you. All your life, and what does it get you? Thanks a lot, out with the garbage. They take vows and you're batting zero. I had a dream. I dreamed it for you, June. It wasn't for me, Herbie. And if it wasn't for me, then where would you be?
Gypsy's magnificently brash, quintessentially American vulgarity makes it one of Broadway's greatest showbiz musicals. The music was composed by Broadway pro Julie Stein, whose best-known showstopper before Gypsy was probably Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And his lyricist was a young Stephen Sondheim, fresh from writing the lyrics for West Side Story. Though they never collaborated again, they were an ideal team. Stein's score was pure Broadway by way of vaudeville and burlesque, memorable yet unpretentious and never artsy. Sondheim's lyrics are by far his earthiest and most colloquial, yet they also have their own kind of Broadway wit and elegance, as in these intricate rhymes in Together Wherever We Go.
Whatever the boat I row, you row.
A duo.
Whatever the row I hoe, you hoe.
A trio.
And any I owe, you owe.
Oh, me owe, no, you owe.
No, we owe together.
We all take. To celebrate Gypsy's 50th anniversary, Sony has reissued the original cast album with some additional material. One highlight is what seems to be a demo of Merman singing the poignant song that in the show the lonely young gypsy sings to her toy animals on her birthday. Anyone who thinks Merman was only a belter needs to hear this recording.
Little cat, ah, why do you look so blue? Did somebody paint you like that? Or is it your birthday too?
New bonus tracks on the cast album include an interview with Julie Stein and a bizarre autobiographical number recorded by Gypsy Rose Lee herself shortly after Gypsy opened.
Hello. I've been in show business almost all my life. My fondest memories are of the years most of you remember as the Depression years. Mother and I were so poor we didn't even know there was a Depression. We went broke during the boom. All we knew was that Vaudeville was dead. How we missed the good old two-a-day. I mean two meals a day, not shows. That's why I started in burlesque. I don't know how I got the job. I was only 15. Of course, I was big for my age. I wasn't exactly what you'd call a stripling of a girl. I was 38 when I was 13.
With the great Merman and the touching Jack Klugman as the man who loves her but can only take so much, Gypsy is one of the best original cast recordings ever made. More than most show albums, it lets us breathe the pungent atmosphere of the whole show, of Broadway itself.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the new 50th anniversary reissue of the original cast album of Gypsy. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids, families, and communities succeed at aecf.org. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the bombing of a luxury hotel in Peshawar, the uprising against the Taliban in one remote Pakistani village, and the spreading fear in Pakistan with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He'll speak to us from Lahore, where he lives. He's the author of the best-selling book, Taliban. Join us for the next Fresh Air.